This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Our Master Cheesemaker program is one of the only two in the world. So it's no wonder every master in America has called Wisconsin home. Find your next favorite cheese and meet our makers at wisconsincheese.com.
Hi, this is Lisa Held, and you're listening to The Farm Report, a Heritage Radio Network show about the people, processes, and policies that shape how food is produced today. Well, today's episode is not really about food, but it is about agriculture, and most ingredients used in natural beauty products like sesame seed and avocado oil, vanilla, turmeric, could also end up on our plates. Adrian DeBonten and his wife, Carolina Priolio, are the husband and wife founders of Maison Made. And to make the certified biodynamic skincare products that they sell, they grow their own medicinal herbs on a family farm in Burgundy and have built a network of small farm suppliers around the world. In this episode, I talked to Adrian about their efforts, from the specifics of biodynamic practices and why they matter, to how biodynamic farming, a system focused on minimizing inputs, building healthy soil, and working with local ecology, compares to systems like organic or regenerative agriculture. Adrian, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So your company makes skincare, and we're going to talk more about that, but the heart of Maison Made is your family farm. It has been in your family for generations, from what I understand. Can we start with just talking a little bit about that? Where is it, and can you share a little bit of the history?
Absolutely. So the farm is located in Burgundy, which is about 90 so miles southeast of Paris. Most people know Burgundy for wine.
including me.
Exactly. Chablis is probably, the most famous of the wines from that region, but we're actually a little bit further north. So we are, very close to the Loire as well. So it's really kind of the tip of northern Burgundy, which historically has been, more agricultural rather than viticultural.
Okay.
The farm has been in our family for, as you said, many generations. The first version of it was actually built in the mid-12th century, but the structure from that time no longer exists, as everything was reconstructed in the 16th century. Kind of a fun fact is that the name of the land and the house is Bontin, which is my last name. So my name literally kind of translates to Adrian from Bontin. So needless to say, it's kind of near and dear to my heart.
The roots are deep, for sure.
Literally and figuratively, yes.
So how was the land farm before you took it over? What did the generations before you grow?
Well, it's difficult to say, what they were doing in, the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th centuries,
right?
Because the bookkeeping back then wasn't, what it is today, let's say. But historically, that region, was focused around grains. So, a lot of wheat, barley, corn, and then one crop that is, kind of historically very much tied to this land is something called colza, which before the advent and proliferation of petroleum was used for lighting and energy purposes in Europe.
That's really interesting.
And
you said that, obviously this is where you're from, but you grew up in the US. So what made you kind of return to the farm and make it such a central part of your current business?
Well, I was born in France, and you're right. I did move to the U.S. at a quite young age and spent most of my upbringing in the U.S. But we always went back every summer. It was, you know, the place where the family would congregate for a good, you know, month, 2 months during the summer. It was in that sense, that's where I learned how to do things with my hands. and it, you know, obviously reconnecting with the family, but also, you know, through my uncles and my grandfather and everything is how I learned how to do the basics of gardening, the basics of farming, you know, what we did on the land, how that all worked, how to drive a tractor. You know, I drove a tractor, I think, for the first time when I was 6 or 7 years old. So, you know, it's, I was there, I guess, frequently, depending on your definition, but at least a month or two out of the year, I would spend in France, in Burgundy with the family. And that's, you know, also where I was able to keep up my French. I was lucky. My mother's Austrian, my dad's French, and so I grew up with French and German, and spending, you know, the summers in France was a way to keep it up. And so obviously, you know, my grandparents and my French side of the family were very happy about that. But it wasn't really until I got a little older where I started really connecting with what it meant to have land. I think that's usually kind of lost on, you know, when you're a teenager, that's not what you're focused on, right? So, or at least I wasn't. And so it was really kind of in my 20s where I started to appreciate, you know, what we had and what we were doing there. And when Carolina and I got together and we started thinking about, you know, if we wanted to create something, you know, what would that be? You know, we didn't want to create just another, you know, fill in the blank brand. We wanted to create something that was unique and special. And we were actually in Burgundy at the time when we were kind of mulling everything over. And, you know, she asked me, you know, why don't you guys grow more things here? And I'm like, I don't know. It's just kind of the way things have been done. And I don't know. It's how it is. And she was like, well, can we grow things? And I'm like, yeah. Yeah, you know, and that's kind of, that's where the idea started. It was, you know, you know, my grandfather, he was kind of very conservative and old school. He was like, there are, you know, the 10 things that grow here and that's it. And since we were kind of focused on skincare, you know, our crops that were of interest to us were more the medicinal and aromatic herbs. And I don't know how much you know about botanical herbs, but they grow, well, I wouldn't say they grow differently, but they are the care or the cultivation of those types of plants is different than, say, you know, maize or wheat or you know, whatever, kind of more the cash crops, let's say. Right. And so, you know, we started with just a little patch of calendula just to kind of see, like, okay, let's see what happens here. And, and they thrived. And this was at the time where I was kind of already entrenched in biodynamics. I had, you know, been doing a lot of research, and plus I kind of grew up with it. My aunt, so on my mother's side, since, you know, that's the Austrian side of the family in Austria, biodynamics is much more prevalent than really anywhere else. So Germany and Austria, it's very kind of common and popular. And so she had been, you know, gardening herself, using biodynamic methods for close to 30 years. And so when we told her that we wanted to, you know, try this out in Burgundy, she got all excited. She, you know, she got in her car and she filled up her car with all sorts of, you know, tools and seeds and all sorts of different accoutrements to kind of help us get started. And, you know, thanks to her, that's where we were able to kind of get the first, you know, few rows started, and then just kind of grew from there.
That's amazing. You had a family consultant, a consultant built into the family already, right?
Yeah, with a vested interest, not who is someone who would just be like, okay, here you go, see you later.
Right, not somebody who just wanted to charge you a lot, but somebody who really cared.
Right, exactly.
That's incredible. So what are some of the, you said you started with calendula. Mm-hmm. What does it look like today? Like, talk a little bit about the different things that you're growing, the variety. I just want to like visualize the farm today.
Sure. So, like I said, we started off with a little square patch of calendula, And because of how well they came out of the ground and our kind of growing interest in really kind of taking on medicinal herbs for the overall property, we started kind of just experimenting with more and more herbs. For us, we always wanted to keep in mind, the native plant species. We didn't want to bring in anything invasive. We weren't, bringing in any Asian plants or, even like South American or North American plants. We really wanted to stay focused on, what grows well in Europe and particularly in Burgundy. So, the first thing we did was we just kind of went around the property and we looked to see what grows naturally. We saw, the stinging nettle was all over the place. We had dandelions. We had St. John's wort. Just a kind of a plethora of plants that were just growing, naturally, and even some pretty amazing ones like valerian and yarrow, and we even had some wild chamomile that was growing in different places. And so clearly, we were like, okay, there's something here. And so today, we grow about 50 different varieties of aromatic herbs and plants. That includes. Obviously, the calendula. We've got a good amount of lavender, chamomile, burdock, comfrey, chickweed. We've got malva and roses, blue cornflower. We have a little orchard of elderberry. I planted my first grapevine this past year, which I'm quite excited about to see if, maybe there is one small benefit to climate change with the weather getting warmer. So, maybe
for your company, at least.
Yeah. we're doing everything we can to combat it.
Right. But,
while it's already here, and that's the thing, with really kind of any agriculture, as the climate changes, we're going to see changes in what can and can't grow in different regions, and so.
Absolutely.
That was also one thing that we were very cognizant of. We wanted to grow plants that were dry and wet resistant, so drought resistant and also flood resistant. Typically just by growing a biodiverse set of plants, you're kind of protecting the land inherently anyway. So, but it was a major consideration in terms of we want to grow plants that are native to the region or at least, adjacent and that can benefit from the way in which our climate is currently, but also in the direction that it's heading.
Right. You mentioned biodiversity, and I know that's a really big principle within biodynamics.
Yes.
Is it enough to just have a variety of herbs and botanicals, or do you need to grow other things in order to have a truly biodynamic system?
Well, I guess that would depend on the biodynamic farmer. it also depends on the size. There are, biodynamic farms that are just a few acres, and then there are some that are a few hundred acres. And so, the approach is different. And, one of the things that I really appreciate about biodynamics is that it really trusts the farmer to know his or her own soil. And so when it comes to biodiversity, I guess the one way in which you can kind of quantify it is that, one way in which biodynamics differs from, let's say organic or really any other certification is that 10% of the acreage must be left for conservation. So the idea being that if you leave, let's say you have 100 acres, mm-hmm. 10 acres will be left alone, so to speak, so that the natural plant species can thrive in that environment and also benefit, typically in the local plant species benefit the local pollinators. And
right.
So the idea is that by reserving 10% of your land for nature to do what she does on her own, you are cultivating a stronger sense of biodiversity.
So you're talking about how 10% of the land when you're using biodynamic systems is left for, left untouched per se.
Right.
What are some of the other kind of key practices that you consider kind of, the foundation of biodynamic agriculture?
Definitely. So what I find very compelling about biodynamics is its history. It was the first well, arguably the first ecological certification for agriculture. You know, its history goes back to the 1920s. There were, you know, the founder of biodynamics was a man named Rudolf Steiner, who is an interesting character, and that could be a whole podcast in and of itself.
Definitely.
Yeah. But, you know, the idea, his ideas, you know, garnered some popularity when, you know, after the advent of, you know, synthetic chemicals started being introduced into the agricultural food systems, you know, farmers started to notice that, you know, it wasn't all, you know, unicorns and rainbows. You know, there was a lot of destruction that was happening at the same time. And Rudolf Steiner, he wanted to kind of re-educate farmers on, you know, how farms used to be run before the Industrial Revolution. And even, you know, the word organic, legend has it, so to speak, came from a conversation with people from Demeter in the 1940s. And so if you think about it, you know, the biodynamic certification comes around in the, you know, 1920s, 1930s. It wasn't until 2002 that the USDA had an organic certification here in the U.S.
Sure.
And so, you know, part of what I very much appreciate is that, you know, biodynamic being a nonprofit, like, really kind of focuses on spreading its message and the movement of sustainable agriculture, and has done so for many decades. In terms of, like, you know, differences between potential, you know, other certifications, one thing that that is unique in my mind is that it's a global certification. So, you know, a biodynamic farm will have in the U.S. Will have the same standards as a biodynamic farm in France or in Mongolia or China or, you know, wherever the farm is located. Demeter really kind of has a core set of standards, and they do slightly vary depending on the country and depending on what's happening. You know, what kind of climates that these different countries have, but 90% is pretty much the same, and that's unique because, let's say, organic, for example. Organic standards in the U.S. are different than they are in Germany, which are different than they are in Argentina, and they're different than every country has their own set of what it means to be an organic product.
Uh-huh.
Then the other thing is that a biodynamic farm, its certification applies to the entire farm. It doesn't apply to specific portions or parcels of land. The farm itself is certified at, in the way in which it manages all of the various components of that farm. So, you know, how much fertilizer and pesticide is coming in, where, you know, what are the sources of that fertilizer and pesticide, even kind of the organic feed that comes in. There are, you know, more restrictions and regulations in terms of how much you can bring in. The idea is really that the farm itself creates its own fertilizers, its own pesticides, mm-hmm. and its own feed, so that it's a self-sustaining organism. That's kind of, you know, a phrase that you might hear a lot from biodynamic people and sources, is that it's really about having the farm being a self-sustaining organism. So it thinks about the farm as one thing, not many different pieces put together that end up, you know, organic or whatever.
Right. And so in your mind, did it feel like being biodynamic was almost like taking a step beyond organic or beyond, like, regenerative organic?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the biodynamic standards use the NOP organic standards as a baseline. So,
got it.
You know, you have to comply, like, every biodynamic farm is organic by in its nature because it has those organic standards as a baseline. Mm-hmm. Whereas not every organic farm is biodynamic, obviously. So
sure.
So the biodynamic farm takes the organic standards and then goes beyond those in terms of, you know, like I said, the restrictions it puts on external feed, fertilizers, and pesticides is intentional because they want the farmer to use local methods. Like, one that we use, for example, is nettle manure. It's very simple process. You basically ferment stinging nettle in water. And if you use it at different stages of fermentation, it works in different ways. So at the beginning stages of fermentation, you can use it as a pesticide because it still has a lot of those stinging properties to it. Whereas if you use it later on in the fermentation stage, it really acts more as a fertilizer. And so biodynamic really kind of fosters the idea that you can create your own inputs rather than rely on, you know, external sources.
Absolutely. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. In Wisconsin, cheese is our thing. Wisconsin is the only state in the country that requires a license to make cheese. From curds to cheddar, blue to brick, Wisconsin cheesemakers can do it all. We blend tradition with innovation to create an incredible variety of cheeses that you just can't get anywhere else. You've heard of a PhD, but have you heard of a PH cheese? Otherwise known as the Wisconsin Master Cheesemaker Program. This rigorous study of cheese is an elite accomplishment earned by only 80 talented cheesemakers in Wisconsin, and the program is only one of two in the world. Becoming a master cheesemaker takes 13 years and is basically like a doctorate in a specific variety of cheese, with intense requirements to succeed. Our Master Cheesemaker Program allows makers to perfect both the art and science of their craft in a tradition so rich you can taste it. Find your next favorite cheese and meet our makers at wisconsincheese.com.
All right, we're back. This is Lisa Held. You're listening to The Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. I've been speaking with Adrian DeBonten from Maison Made, and we were talking about the practices and benefits of biodynamic farming before the break. And I want to ask you about, actually, right before you mentioned inputs, right? Mm-hmm. Some of the inputs in biodynamic go beyond what many people would consider scientific and sort of start to touch even like the spiritual realm, right? There's
definitely
a link to astronomical cycles. There's an input that people always mention called horn manure, made from bearing manure and a cow horn. I'd love to hear you just kind of talk a little bit about, well, I guess it's two questions. One, like, does a farmer have to embrace all of these elements to truly farm biodynamically? And how do you respond to people who think those parts might sound a little bit out there?
Definitely. So for your first question, you don't have to follow all of the different, let's say, recommendations around astronomical cycles. The main aspect is the what are called the 9 biodynamic preparations. There are 6 preparations for compost, and then there are 3 spray preparations.
Okay. Now,
those you need to follow in order to be certified biodynamic. And, you know, you have, they might seem a little out there, but the idea is that, you know, for example, you mentioned the horn manure.
Right.
So the way it works is, and please remember, like, I'm really kind of generalizing here and boiling it down. There are, you know, various aspects that might be a little bit more minute and detailed. And I'm sure that the biodynamic farmers who might be listening will, you know, say, well, that's not everything. But I'm trying to keep it simple. So
there's always more. Yeah. You don't have to do everything. Yeah.
Exactly. The idea behind the horn manure, as I understand it, and I would still consider myself a novice in biodynamics because I just started a couple of years ago or a few years ago. But the idea is that the horn of the cow is really part of the nasal cavity. So as a cow kind of chews and digests the food, there's a certain kind of energy that goes in within the horns as being a part of the nasal cavity. And, you know, what cows do all day is they chew grass, right? So the premise of the Biodynamic Prep 500, which is the horn manure, is that by utilizing the horn of a cow and filling it with fairly fresh manure and then burying it over the winter, is that you're drawing as the soil kind of draws energy inward during the winter. A lot of those elements of that energy is coming into contact with the horn and the manure that's there. And then in the spring, you unearth them, and basically you take the manure out of the horn. And at this point, it's really interesting because it does go through a transformational process. It's not the same as when it went in. It doesn't smell bad. By the way, manure shouldn't smell bad, but many people might think that it does. The good manure doesn't smell that bad. but in any way, so when you take the manure out of the horn in the spring, it's this really kind of delicate black material. And so what you do is you mix it in with preferably some rainwater. That you activate, or what they call dynamizing. So you move the water in a bucket, let's say. Kind of depends on how much you're going to be spraying.
Okay.
But you move that water around to kind of activate the water to get the molecules in the water moving. And then when you put the manure from the horn inside the water, it kind of melds with that energy, and then you use that to spray your fields to kind of get the season ready. It's kind of like a fertilizer, a soil starter, let's say. And then, you know, going into, you know, the other aspects in terms of, you know, the astronomical cycles and all that, those are really more, I would say, guides than anything else. And the reason why it is kind of prevalent with biodynamic farmers is because I believe a biodynamic farmer really has a lot of intent when they approach their land and the things that they choose to grow and how they choose to grow them. And so I mm-hmm. think it's more representational of, you know, that connection that these biodynamic farmers have. You know, typically they're smaller farms. You know, if we look at, you know, all types of farms, they're definitely sure. smaller farms. And, you know, typically, or I should say generally, a biodynamic farmer is not, his primary concern is not the bottom line. It, you know, his or her main concern is really connecting with the soil and being a steward of their land. This kind of goes into the second part of your question, which is, you know, what would I say to people who say, oh, it's not based on science, it's not based
yeah.
on, you know, soil science is really difficult. It's not really a science because, you know, you're dealing with weather, you're dealing with, you know, external factors that you can't really predict year over year. Mm-hmm. You know, you might have some sort of pest this year that you didn't have last year, or you might have, I don't know, 50% more rain than you did the year before. So that washes things out. You know, the fertilizers that you input might not be. So, you know, the idea that, like, you need to have this hardcore science behind, you know, why a biodynamic tomato tastes better than another tomato, you know, I would argue that, like, you know, the science behind you know, any one of these is very difficult to calculate, and there are a few people out there who are doing a good job of it. Actually, I don't know if you know about the Savory Institute, but they're really mm-hmm. looking at, you know, regenerative practices and the effect on soil, and is it in fact, you know, storing more carbon in the soil than if not,
right?
And so, you know, when we talk about regenerative practices, I mean, the way I see it is that biodynamic is certified regenerative agriculture. You know, all the practices that they do is, you know, regenerative. It's the idea
yeah.
is that your soil is better year after year. You're not draining nutrients out of the soil. You're constantly making it better. And that's the general idea behind regenerative. And so, you know, the term is being thrown around quite a bit, and mm-hmm. There's a lot of people who are throwing it around without really any backbone behind it. And it's another mm-hmm. reason why I really appreciate biodynamics, is because with that certification, with the biodynamic certification, you know that it comes from regenerative agriculture. And aside from, you know, maybe regenerative organic and some others that came about in the last few years as this term got popular. There's not that many out there. And, you know, I would, the reason why I would choose biodynamic even over the newer certifications is, part, like I said before, it's an old certification.
The history,
The history, you know, it's proven itself to be value-based and not, you know, marketing or profit-based.
Right. You know, despite the history there, you mentioned that biodynamic farming is a little bit bigger in Europe compared to here in the States. But overall, it's still a pretty small chunk, right, of agriculture. Yeah. So you've got a very small farm where you're growing some of the ingredients for your products, but mm-hmm. I would imagine that you need a lot more in order to do your formulations, right? And I, you know, I was looking at some of the ingredients and it's pretty clear a lot of them wouldn't grow in Burgundy, like jojoba or avocado oil.
Right.
So how are you finding enough suppliers that are certified biodynamic to, you know, actually create these products, like to get all those ingredients that you need?
Time. It took us about 3 years to develop our supply network. And I call it a network because, you know, we have direct relationships with each one of the farmers that actually produces the ingredients that we use, whether that be a hydrosol, an oil, or, you know, a dried plant. And, you know, many of the ingredients that we are currently using for our skincare products were developed for us because of those relationships that we established a number of years ago. Like you said, we don't grow everything that is in our products, and nor could we. And so the majority of our supply network is in Europe. And as you mentioned, it is a larger, or there's more of a understanding of biodynamics, and there's a good amount of farms, even though it's still tiny. I mean, even organic farms in the U.S. are less than 2% of all farms. So you can just imagine what biodynamic is. So, we try to do it as local as possible, right? So the majority, I would say over 90% of the suppliers that we work with are either Europe or U.S. based. There's one or two that we get out of Africa because that's where those plants grow. We would love to be able to do everything ourselves, but that's just not necessarily the case.
I guess having the certification in place also gives you that ability to find farms elsewhere and already have kind of a third party that is telling you this is in line with the principles you want your product, right? Like, I mean, if you were doing regenerative, or it would be harder because you wouldn't totally know how that was being interpreted on each farm. But
you would have to essentially create your own definition of what regenerative means, right?
Yeah.
And that's again part of my problem with the word regenerative is that it means different things to different people. Again, as you said, coming in and approaching a farm that already has biodynamic certification, where, you know, we as a company have our biodynamic certification as a handler and sell biodynamic products, it's a family kind of atmosphere. So there is that kind of familial aspect between biodynamic people that, you know, we know the extra steps that we go through as a company or as a farm to deserve their logo on our products or on our crops. And so the conversation is, you know, starts off in a good place already. Then, you know, it's a matter of, you know, do they have the bandwidth to work with us on the ingredients that we need, you know, for our products today, and then also for the products that we're working on for the future. So, you can't just go online and buy these ingredients. Yeah, it's not that easy. You can't go to a lab and ask them, "Oh, make me a biodynamic face oil." It's part of, you know, what makes us special, and also why we work very hard.
Right. Definitely not the easiest path to take.
No.
But on the flip side, I guess, how do the farming practices impact the quality of the products?
What do you mean?
Like, I'm curious if you think that the fact that all of the ingredients are biodynamic results in a higher quality skincare product as opposed to if the ingredients were grown conventionally.
Well, I think it's about supporting.
Sorry, I interrupted you. I was just going to say, I guess, like, you know, you'd have to really measure, I think, aside from anecdotally,
you'd have
to measure, like, are you getting higher vitamin content,
I can also, you know, answer that in a different way, which is, you know, when we work with either with the plants that we grow on our farm for our skincare products, or we work with the biodynamic farmers that grow these ingredients for us, what we look for is a certain level of expertise with the plants that we're looking for. So when it comes to oils, it's a little bit easier. But you know, when it comes to dried plants, for example, calendula, you want to harvest them and dry them in a very specific manner in order to retain the medicinal qualities that we then look for to put into our skincare products. Mm. Same thing with lavender, for example. We harvest lavender when we see about 25% of the buds starting to open. We don't want them when they're full flowering, because at that point, the kind of the internal chemistry of the plant has already begun to change. And so it's about that knowledge in terms of, you know, where is the plant, today? Milky oats. You know, many people know about milky oats. It's like a 1 week, 2 week stage maximum where you can harvest oats when they're in that milky phase in order to get the milky oats. And so, like, that's the case for many of the ingredients that we work with. And so when we say that we have higher quality ingredients, the one way that we measured it is we sent our face oil, which is, at the end of the day, it's an antioxidant face oil, right? It's brimming with antioxidants, and that helps the skin kind of age more gracefully. And the way in which we were able to quantify that is we sent it to a lab based in the UK that measures antioxidant potential of whatever. You know, you could send them an apple, or you could send them our face oil, for example. And so they do tests on cosmetic products. And when they came back with our results, they said it was one of the highest they've ever seen for a product in that category. Is that because of biodynamics? I would say yes. But right. how do you know for sure?
There's no way, I guess, to perfectly.
And there are some farmers that aren't biodynamic that do the same thing and that get high quality stuff.
Sure.
And so it's really like what I was saying before, it's about knowing the farmer, knowing their level of expertise, how they care for the plants that they grow and how they harvest them, how they process them, how they store them. Do they go through multiple different hands? Do they travel all over the world before they end up in the final location? That's another rabbit hole that we could go down to in terms of kind of like the aromatic herb industry and, you know, where these plants come from, how they're harvested and, you know, the different hands that they go through. But for us, it's really about having a direct connection with our supply network and knowing how they treat their plants is in line with how we would do it if we were in their shoes.
Right. So you've been able to develop this network of suppliers. I think we're talking about skincare. Often when we talk about biodynamic, we talk about wine. We brought that up before.
Yeah.
These tend to be sort of high value items, right? That you can command a little bit of a higher price compared to, you know, a basic food item like an egg or a vegetable. So, like, I want to just talk a little bit before we wrap up, like, given sort of the labor intensity of biodynamics, do you think it's possible to apply this kind of farming in systems that are producing products that aren't luxury that isn't wine, skincare, that's a little bit more basic, given the potential benefits.
Absolutely. In terms of, what makes something luxury is subjective, right? But what I was explaining before about, the farmers who know how to, take care of their plants, harvest, process, and store them, to me, that's luxury. The way in which they are able to capture the medicinal qualities of the plants that we look for in skincare, to me, that's quality. But at the end of the day, calendula, it grows pretty much everywhere. I wouldn't consider right. it a luxury item, right? And I would also say that the majority of biodynamic farms, again, they're not looking to make high value items. They're farms like any other organic farm. And so they produce eggs and, the lower price point items as well. There's a number here in the US, I'm thinking of one that's a dairy farm, right? They're biodynamic. They make fantastic raw milk, but it's still milk, right? And the places that we work with where they have, what we would consider to be more exotic ingredients like, sesame or vanilla or, whatever, for them, that's what grows there. So,
right.
They can command a higher price point outside of, their own countries. But for them, it's the same approach. It's the same level of attention and detail and care that they put into their plants, whether that be vanilla or whether that be milk or eggs or wheat, oats, whatever it is. And so, for me, the luxury aspect comes in more in terms of the expertise that these farmers have when it comes to the plants that they choose to grow.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I was just thinking about, the kind of care it takes to really execute this kind of, like you called it intentional before, right? And mm-hmm. to be participating in that kind of agriculture, it does take time and labor. And, it's not, like we said, it's not the easiest. After I asked that question, I thought, well, there's also a potential economic benefit, which is that you don't have to buy any inputs really, right?
The expensive part is really becoming biodynamic. That's right. Where you have to change the way in which you've been doing things for a long time. Even if you're an organic farm, you're like, okay, now I gotta have to learn how to make these preparations. How do I do this? You can buy preparations too. You don't have to make them yourself, right? So mm-hmm. it's preferable that you make them yourself because it comes from your land and is in line with that ethos of, your farm creating its bounty, right? But once you are biodynamic, the labor intensity goes down significantly because, you're growing things that your soil likes. You've cultivated your soil to an extent where, you probably have less weeds. You don't need all of those synthetic chemical inputs that other farms might. I would argue that, the beginning is intensive. It's a change. You have to change in which the way that you do things, that you've been doing things for a long time. Once you've been biodynamic for a few years, it's about having a self-sustaining single organism that creates its own beauty and bounty in and of itself.
Right. Before we wrap up, Adrian, what's next for Maison Made?
Well, we have a few products coming out next year, which we're quite excited about. We haven't announced anything yet, so I can't okay. talk specifics. But we have our products are put into two collections, and the first one is our Maison collection, which is really our collection of products that have a more complex formulation approach. From Carolina, my wife, who's our formulator, so she takes in all of our biodynamic ingredients and approaches it from a kind of skin supporting perspective, we'll have a couple of products come out in that collection. And then our second collection is our Verdant collection, which really focuses on single ingredient products, where the goal behind this collection is really to highlight the the exquisiteness of biodynamic ingredients. And, we choose products or ingredients that we feel can really highlight that difference. We'll be having some products come out in that collection as well next year. So we have a whole slew of new things coming. That we're very excited about, and looking forward to seeing how people react to them.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
And thank you all so much for listening to the Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. If you enjoyed the conversation, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, and share it. Until next time, this is Lisa Held.
The Farm Report is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Just enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.